plus.
All right.
B minus, B, flat B maybe.
She's a British 7, you're saying?
Yeah, she's a 7.
Okay.
Hey, this is FMU and you're on the radio.
Hi, I think the prettiest princess is Batman's sidekick Robin.
That is hard to argue with.
Mm-hmm. What's your name, sister?
My name's the Beatrice.
Okay.
Now, which Robin are you referencing here? Because to me, it's always like, Burt Ward from the TV show in the 60s.
I think, like, any of them.
You mean
how could any
the
of
character?
Them not be a pretty princess? It's just all of them.
Okay, because that character's changed a little bit. Because originally he was, like, 14 or something in the comic books back in the 30s? And then he got older over time.
I don't think princesses change, even with age. They stay the same.
Okay,
Beatrice, you're on my list. Listen at the end of the hour.
All right, thanks.
Have a good one.
You too.
Although I do think there is a difference between the 60s TV Batman and, like, the Teen Titans Batman, which is what my daughter would know from.
FMU, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I think Robert Pattinson is a pretty princess.
That's
Robert
a good
Robert Pattinson?
One.
Yeah. That's a good one.
We're getting a lot of lady callers today.
Is that a good thing?
We never get this many. It is a good thing.
Gender equality is our pretty princess.
They're
of
just
honor.
More interested in princesses.
Yeah.
What's your name, sister?
Oh, Daisy.
We should do more girly calls. Is this the Daisy I know?
No, another one.
But you've called before, haven't you?
Yeah, I called into the Revenge show.
Yes. Okay.
To the witch show?
Revenge. Because all pretty princesses secretly have their mind on revenge.
That's true, Andy Cohen.
You do not want to cross a pretty princess.
All right, Daisy,
ever.
Thanks for calling.
I learned that the hard way
from
you.
Have a good one. Excuse me, I will stab you.
Like I said, got to be on my guard all the time with you.
Had it with you.
What?
FMU, you're on the radio.
Yo, the Prince of England.
He's a pretty princess?
Wait,
oh, yeah.
Which one? Prince Charles?
The cute one or the ugly one?
The one, the tall one that's about to get married.
Ew, he's disgusting.
Well, that's Prince William.
He is kind of a pretty princess.
And then what's his brother's name?
Harry.
Harry, oh, the Nazi one.
The hot one.
Yeah. Oh, you think he's the hot one?
Oh, yeah. And when they grew up, the older one got so ugly. He's losing his hair.
Like his dad?
He's nasty.
Okay.
The other one's hot.
Okay.
All right, have a good one. Thanks for calling.
So you're saying you wouldn't want to be a literal, actual British style pretty princess?
Would I?
Yeah.
I'd marry that hairy dude.
No, but he's not in line to be, I guess.
Oh, right.
His wife
well,
becomes a duchess.
Well, if what's his name
duchess.
Dies, then isn't it him?
Well, no, because there's the queen and then her son, Prince Charles. So if the queen were to die, Prince Charles becomes king.
Yeah, I got that part.
Okay.
And then he dies, it's...
Or steps down. He could abdicate. Then it's William.
Right. But if William dies...
Before his younger brother, then his younger brother Harry would become king.
So you only have to kill off 3 people to get there.
That's the way you want to think about it? Yes.
I'm just saying.
Okay.
Why are you mad at me?
Because you're plotting murder on...
You're the one who put me in the princess position
the
here.
The FCC would not like us plotting the murder of the royal family.
FMU, you're
you
on the
You plotting
air.
The murder of the royal family.
Hey, what's up?
Yo, are you drunk?
Pretty princess time.
Hi, I think Emma Watson is a princess because she sued somebody for making fun of her for being in Harry Potter.
Oh, Emma Watson from the Harry Potter movies. Okay,
yeah,
Hermione.
Okay. I like her, so I'm not going to diss on her.
No, I like her. Don't get me wrong. She's pretty and she's cool. But how can you sue somebody for something like that?
I'm going to sue everyone who makes fun of me, too.
Okay, pretty princess.
I'm just kidding.
Pretty princess to the both of you.
Have a good one, mister. I mean, missus.
No, I'm a girl. Sorry.
I just said I mean missus. Sorry.
She got it wrong.
Sometimes it just comes out like that.
It's okay.
Although when a pretty princess makes a mistake like that, you just have to agree with them.
Yeah, just agree with me.
It's okay.
All right, have a good one, sister. Yeah. I didn't like her.
How's it hanging, dude? What? You didn't like her?
I didn't like the way she sounded like she was at a frat party.
It's Friday night.
FMU, you're on the air.
We're surrounded by colleges.
Oh, that's fantastic. Okay, so I have 3 possible candidates for you for pretty princess.
Okay.
Okay, so Ace Frehley is number one.
Ace Frehley?
Who's that?
From Kiss?
The second one. And the Land O'Lakes Indian Butter Lady.
Okay, Land O'Lakes Butter Lady. I missed the second one.
Oh, Bryce Krishnamurti.
Our Bryce.
That's our Bryce?
Yeah.
Exactly. That is your Bryce.
Is he a pretty princess?
He looked like one when we told him the topic and he batted his little eyelashes at me.
Ooh. Can we award that?
Not Ace Frehley.
No, we can't award that.
You know who that is, right? The one who's not
Kiss guy?
Yeah.
Which one is he?
The one who's not the guy with the long tongue or Peter Criss.
The star?
Is he the star? I'm not sure which is which.
The star looks like a pretty princess to me.
Well, what about all the members of Kiss? You think like when the makeup they don't all look like pretty princess?
I like the guy who has that show.
That's Gene Simmons?
Yeah, I like him.
The tongue one.
Yeah, he's cool.
Now, what is he, the star or the cat? I can never keep track of these things.
I think Gene Simmons is the star.
Gene Simmons is the star.
Even though he plays bass, like, he's the star.
So Ace Frehley's the cat?
No, he's talking about the face paint.
I think Ace Frehley, he's the guy with the star.
Man, I don't know. Who cares? All right, have a good one, sister.
Thank you.
Okay, we're coming up on the end of the show here.
What does the real clock
say? The real clock says 6:56:39.
FMU, you're on the air. Hello?
Hello?
Jerk.
Hi, you're on the air.
I'll hung up.
Okay.
All right, so listen.
Yeah?
These are my two options.
Time to get real here.
Yeah.
It is getting real now.
It's time to get down to the dirty business. The dirty, dirty.
So you don't want to take another half dozen calls, which is what you typically want to do at the 657 mark.
We don't have any right now.
Really?
Yeah, because I haven't given out the number.
Then it's just us.
Jenny?
In the arena of trying to make
decisions. We've got Jenny with Rob Lowe.
Rob Lowe.
Or Beatrice with Robin from Batman and Robin.
The Beatrice, I think she said. Well, I'm still strong on, I'm still sweet on Henry Rollins.
No.
No? Come on.
Jenny or Beatrice, pick one.
Wait, I'm sorry, which means
Rob Lowe or Robin.
Well, not the two, Rob Lowe. But I'm still carrying a torch for Henry Rollins here.
Not my winner.
Well, what about David Beckham?
Not my winner.
Taylor Momsen?
Nope.
Shirley Cruz?
Rob Lowe.
Bono or Bono?
Nobody even called in with that one. We just misheard.
Kate Middleton.
FMU, you're on the air.
Zach Morris from Saved by the Bell.
That's a good one. All right, thanks for calling.
Better than Henry Rollins?
Have a good
one. I don't think so.
Jenny with Rob Lowe is my winner. She can email me her address and her t-shirt size at shutupweirdo@wfmu.org.
Are we still giving out t-shirts?
Yeah, we got plenty.
We have some left?
I gave out one today.
To who?
To the 9-year-old girl who called last week saying she was going to be eaten by a bear at the Walmart.
Eaten by bears.
I think her name was, I forgot.
She's our pretty princess from last week.
She is our little pretty princess.
Yes. Is there any other pretty princesses you want to give a shout out to?
Just you, Andy. Just you.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Any other last thoughts before we end the show?
This was fun. I had a great time.
Best topic ever?
Yeah.
Okay. You've been listening to Shut Up Weirdo here on WFMU. You can comment during the show at WFMU.org. And we have a show page at shutupweirdo.com, which has links to Facebook, Twitter, and iTunes. All our previous shows are there. I'm Andy.
I'm Fran Green.
Up next is Tautophonic Todd, filling in for Mr. Fine Wine. Chris T is ostensibly in at 8, and then Sue Braun at 9 p.m. You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, live and archived at WFMU.org.
Let's end it here.
It's time for Josh and Chuck and Stuff You Should Know, the program that exposes the internal workings of life on this planet. This is the radio version of the Stuff You Should Know podcast, which is available from HowStuffWorks.com. Tonight, Josh and Chuck explore the ancient question, does a human being remain conscious for any period of time after decapitation? And then in part two, Josh and Chuck take on another life and death issue. They investigate the world of suicide bombers. Now here's Josh and Chuck.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuck Bryant asleep at the mic. Wake up, Chuck.
I could fall asleep right now.
What's wrong with you? Is it pollen?
No.
It just means haywire?
I'm just sweepy.
Are you?
Yeah.
You have a long night last night?
Yeah, I hadn't been sleeping that great.
Oh, really?
Plus, I got the window open because the weather's so nice, but that means I hear birds in traffic really early, so I've been waking up at like 6:15.
Yeah, I hate that. I hate those birds.
I do too.
The early birds with catching their worms. I heard them.
Stupid happy songs.
Yeah, I don't like that either. I had weird, uncomfortable dream last night that I was trying to rent a car and everything was sold out because Texas A&M was in some sort of crazy championship and there's like 500,000 people there and they'd rented all the cars. So I had to stand around and wait until somebody brought a car back and jump on that. And there was like 12 other people doing the same thing. It was kind of
stressful.
Texas
A&M.
That's no odd. Idea why.
Out of nowhere, huh?
Yeah.
I thought at least it'd be UT.
No. It was A&M.
UT.
So, Chuck.
So weird.
You know what that was? That was an example. Dreams in general are an example of my neural networks. Whatever I'd learned or thought of that day, or something had jogged my memory, whatever.
Sure.
There's an idea that dreams are basically your brain strengthening neural networks by stimulating different ones.
Right.
Basically doing some paperwork, some sorting while your body's sleeping.
Yeah, we still haven't done our Deluxe Dream podcast, have we?
We haven't. Somebody asked for it recently.
Yeah, we'll do it.
I think we're getting more and more prepared too. It's
yes,
coming. Okay.
It's coming.
But that idea is based on it's one of the things that's based on what a guy named Francis Crick, who you'll remember was one of the co-discoverers of the structured DNA.
Yeah, he was the D, right?
Yeah.
Oh no.
You're thinking of Run DMC.
Right.
Yeah. He later on in his career really got into the idea of this thing called the astonishing hypothesis.
I love this.
But it's a little depressing, if you ask me. We've talked about it before.
Yeah.
I think we talked about it in Mirror Neurons.
Yeah.
But the astonishing hypothesis is essentially that all of our thoughts, our dreams, our beliefs, our hopes, our fears, our connections to others, every aspect of the human experience is based on neurons and their excitement, right? And he said, quite famously, quote,
you're nothing but a bowl of neurons.
Or pack.
I like bowl.
Okay. But I said quote.
Yeah.
So you're just rewriting correct.
How about a sack of neurons? I like that.
A fistful of neurons.
Oh, God, that's awesome.
Thank you.
Fistful. That's a band name right there.
I knew you were going to say that.
Fistful of neurons?
Yeah.
Someone's going to go be that now.
Yes. So as at the basis of all of this is the neurotransmitter, right?
Yes.
Which is an electrochemical compound that depending on what kind of neuron is excited or what compound is passed from synapse to synapse, right?
Yeah.
You're going to have a different kind of experience, but all of these experiences are based on these electrochemical reactions.
That's
in your neural networks.
That's right.
So you have one neuron exciting another and they become connected and it goes on and then mm-hmm. you have a neural network that's associated with fear or a fear of bears more specifically. You see a bear and it's excited because you stored this neural network as a memory.
Right.
And that's consciousness.
That's being alive, as they say.
Right. It kind of takes the mystery out of life to a certain extent, don't you think?
Yeah, but it also, and that's a great setup too for this, it also, you know, as long as you can measure that and you can measure those brain waves, that means there's something going on there.
Right, because we do have machines called electroencephalographs,
yeah,
EEGs, that measure the electrical activity in your head. And we've determined, science has come to agree, that there's a strong enough correlation between somebody going, hey, why is this thing on my head? And electrical activity while it's happening,
yeah,
that when we detect this electrical activity, we're saying this person's conscious.
Right.
Right?
Right. And that is a great way to set up a study that was performed in the Netherlands. He's wacky Dutch.
Yeah.
At Radboud. I'm sure that's not pronounced correctly.
I would say Radboud.
Radboud University in the Netherlands.
Where in the Netherlands?
It's that word.
I know. It's a lot of consonants right there.
Nijmegen.
That's what I'm going with.
And that's one of the easier looking Dutch words I've seen. If you go over there, it's crazy.
Yeah.
So they did this, you know, when you work with lab rats, sometimes you have to put them to death. And what they do is they chop their little heads off.
Yeah.
Because they, you know, that's a quick and speedy way to kill something.
Yeah.
So they thought, you know, we might want to do some tests to see if this is actually a humane way of doing this.
Which is what they thought all along, which is why they decapitate
yeah.
rats and other lab animals, is because it's assumed that's humane.
Right.
These Dutch researchers are saying, well, wait a minute, is it? Let's find out.
I would think smothering one with a tiny pillow would be...
While petting it.
Yeah, while stroking it.
I've thought about that too, but fear.
Yeah, sure.
Because I think we should probably define humane here. Humane is probably the absence of fear and pain. It's a humane way to kill something on purpose.
Yeah.
Right?
Those are probably the two things I would want cut out of my death.
Yes.
Fear and pain. So they did this. They performed these tests on rats, attached them to the little EEGs, cut off their heads, and they found that the brain continued to operate, generate electrical activity between 13 and 100 hertz frequency, mm-hmm. which is, that means thought and consciousness.
Right. Study of electrical activity in the brain, we found that within that band, that frequency band, those frequency
right.
bands, that's when you're thinking and feeling and saying, what is going on?
Right. Why is my lifeless body over there without my head on it?
Right.
For about 4 seconds, and then lights out.
Yeah, lights out. And then I think after about another 50 seconds or something, 40 or 50 seconds, there was one last burst.
Lights back on?
It wasn't exactly lights back on. It was like the end of everything in one last point.
Oh.
But there was nothing between those that indicated consciousness. It was just like everything was gone after about 50 seconds. But 4 seconds... consciousness.
Right. Which brings us to capital punishment. The way they came up with that originally is from the Latin term caput, which means head. So decapitation mm-hmm. was where capital punishment is derived from, decapitation.
That's exactly right.
And so now we can talk about humans losing their heads.
Well, yeah, because as we said, a humane way of executing something or dispatching something is to take fear and pain out of it, right?
Yeah.
And the study of these rats suggests that, hold on, I want everybody to do this, right? I want you to look around, to think, to feel, to listen while I count 4 seconds off. You ready?
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4. Took a lot in just then, didn't you?
A lot more than I'd be comfortable taking in with my head not attached to my body.
Exactly. So here's this is why the rat study is so disturbing, because it suggests that after your head is cut off, you are still very much aware of what's going on and can think and yeah. feel and be terrified, right?
Yes. And, you know, I wish I had a better source for this, but I did find one doctor that firmly believes that there's a lot of pain associated with a decapitation, yeah. Execution by decapitation.
Yes.
Maybe not for long, but he's like, I don't know about this painless thing.
Right. Well, and long before this Dutch study was published, people have long suspected, like, this, you're still conscious after you're decapitated for a little while, right?
Let's talk about decapitation.
First, I want to give a shout out to our buddy Alan Bellows from Damn Interesting, who wrote a great article as well.
Do you know him?
That, he emails with us sometimes.
Oh, okay, yeah.
He wrote one called Lucid Decapitation that I use as a source for this. It's great.
I read that today, too.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, Chuck, let's do talk about a history of head loss, as it were.
And not losing one's head as in losing one's cool.
No.
You mean chopper style.
Although you do probably lose your cool when you lose your head and you're still conscious.
We'll find out. In the biblical Apocrypha, I love that word, there's a widow named Judith. She cut off the head of an Assyrian general named Holofernes.
Uh-huh.
And he was a bad guy laying siege to her town. She cut his head off.
Yep.
Romans did
she
that.
She seduced him. And then cut his head off.
Oh, that's the way to do it.
Especially if you're a biblical widow.
Right. The Romans did that to their own because they thought it was a better and more painless way than crucifixion, which they did to outsiders.
Yes.
Which is not a very nice way to die.
No.
Medieval Europe, obviously. All kinds of people, from the ruling class to peasants. And today it still happens in a few Middle Eastern countries.
Yeah. Qatar, Yemen, Iran, most prominently Saudi Arabia.
Yeah,
you've seen Fahrenheit 9/11? There's footage of like a somebody being beheaded in public in Saudi Arabia in like the late 90s.
Did they use the sword?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yep. The Shmitar.
And Josh, there are also the extra judicial, like when, you know, a journalist is captured and beheaded by a group of guerrillas, and yeah. that's not like they don't use a sword or a guillotine. It's really gruesome.
Yes. It's extremely gruesome.
That's right.
That's why most modern cultures have come to the conclusion that beheading is extremely barbaric.
Mm-hmm.
It's an extremely painful way to die, and I imagine probably one of the more terrifying ways to die, too.
Yes.
But it took a while for everybody to come to that conclusion, right?
Yeah, and you mentioned Saudi Arabia is one of the main countries. They have, I guess you would call, very qualified swordsmen.
Yes.
To do this.
Yeah.
But other places, they're not so qualified, and it doesn't go as smoothly. Sometimes there's like some chopping that has to go on,
well, right,
which is not ideal.
And one of the reasons why it isn't ideal is because it takes chopping, or it did for many, many centuries, because you had to either do it with a knife,
yeah,
which was really like not a beheading. It was more cutting someone's head off over yeah. the course of a few minutes, probably.
Yeah.
Or you could try to behead somebody with an axe or a sword. And those were the two favored implements used yeah. for state-sanctioned executions, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, like you said, in some cultures, like Saudi Arabia today, you have to be you're a very highly trained, highly skilled headsman is what it's called.
Yeah.
In other cultures, you could have also doubled as the guy who like pulled the lever on the gallows.
Right.
And you had no extra training. Maybe you'd done it once before, maybe you hadn't. So for the most part, when you were beheaded, most likely it was going to take more than one blow.
Yeah.
And you're going to feel it.
Yes.
Then everything changed.
Yes, the guillotine.
Yes. Chuck, give them the fact of, well, one of the facts of this this podcast.
Yeah, I've always heard, and I think a lot of people have always heard, the guillotine was named after Joseph Guillotine, the inventor of the guillotine.
Mm-hmm.
He was not the inventor of the guillotine.
No, it was named after him.
It was named after him, but he was not the inventor.
He was the champion of the guillotine as a humane method of execution.
Yeah, he was. Was he a doctor? No.
Yeah.
He was?
He was a French physician
okay.
Of the Revolution. Another doctor named Antoine Louis was the one who actually invented it. And Joseph Ignace Guillotin had a lot more power and clout and said, this invention is awesome.
Yeah.
It's going to allow us to kill people more humanely, but also more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually led inadvertently, if you know, the guillotine
sure.
started out to be a humane method of execution, to what's called the Reign of Terror.
Yeah, I think you said 30,000 people hit the guillotine in 1 year?
In less than a year, actually. And 30,000 is one of the lower estimates of it. I've seen up to like 50 or 60,000 people.
Yeah.
It's just like they're like, oh, great. Well, here's a machine of execution.
Yeah.
And we're going to basically turn it into the end of the assembly line.
Yeah, it's, you know, for those of you who don't know what a guillotine is, a little odd because they're all over the place in cartoons even and in pop culture.
Yeah.
But it's a big, it's a tall, like 14 feet tall.
At the top, yes, 14.
And it drops a large blade that's held in a track, so it goes straight down. How heavy?
So the blade itself has a weight at the top. You
yeah.
see it's like an iron bar, and then the angled blade, right?
Yeah.
Diagonal blade. Those two things combined weigh about 175 pounds or 80 kilograms.
The mouton?
The mouton is the weight, yes.
So this puppy slides down very fast at 14 feet in its track.
Yep.
Very precisely hits the back of your neck.
It's very sharp.
And that generally means your head will probably just fall straight down into the little peach basket.
Right.
Ideally.
Right. Now, if you are, if you were beheaded prior to the invention of the guillotine, right?
Prior to this podcast.
And also, I have to say, like, you're right. Everybody knows what a guillotine looks like
yeah.
to a certain extent. It wasn't until I wrote this and was doing research for it that I really actually looked at the actual guillotine,
mm-hmm.
the whole assembly, right? I mean, look at that thing. That monster is horrific. And it's like that's used by the state, and that's how you are going to die. You're going to lose your head.
Yeah.
And Victor Hugo famously said that a person can have a certain indifference on the death penalty as long as one has not seen a guillotine with one's own eyes.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, very true.
It's pretty easy to talk a tough game about things like this until you actually see it go down.
Exactly.
So the guillotine, what it does is, most notably, is it deprives your brain of oxygen and blood.
Right. Your circulatory system, it's a closed system.
Yeah.
Right? So it's based on pressure. Your heart is pumping the blood throughout the body. It passes by the lungs, drops off CO2, which you exhale. It takes in oxygen, which you inhale, mm-hmm. and then the whole thing goes again, right? As long as the system is closed and the heart's beating and the lungs are transferring air, you're fine. Once you take a head off, you have opened this closed system.
Yeah.
And eventually the heart's going to just pump everything out
mm-hmm.
of the neck. And whatever was in the head at that time is going to come out. And the brain, starved of oxygen and blood, starts to degrade very quickly. Its processes start to degrade, right?
Yeah.
Now, if you are at the hands of a hack, literally, a headsman, right, who doesn't know what he's doing, he's got a blunt blade, he's hungover, who knows?
Right.
He's going to take your head off.
Got a disco eye.
It's going to take a few... What is a disco eye? Okay. It's going to take it's going to take a few hacks, and you're going to bleed out probably before your head comes off. Not so with the guillotine.
Instant.
It is very precise.
Yeah.
It comes right down. Mm-hmm. It takes your head right off. And then there's a little wooden shield to make sure that it doesn't go flying into the crowd.
Sure.
Instead, it maybe hits the shield and then bounces into the basket.
Yeah.
Where a headsman can hold it up.
Yeah, or sometimes throw it into the crowd. Didn't know they did that.
Yeah.
Interesting. And sometimes they would be big jerks. In the case, a very famous case of Charlotte Corday.
Yeah.
She was executed in France in 1793 because she assassinated a revolutionary leader named Jean-Paul Marat.
Mm-hmm.
And the jerk executioner picked up her head and smacked her around a little bit.
Yeah, he got 11 years in prison for it, too.
And people who witnessed this say that her expression on her headless head, I'm sorry, her head, bodiless head.
Her dismembered head.
Disembodied. Good Lord. Showed unequivocal marks of indignation. So she actually had a facial expression of like, how dare you slap me?
Right, and it wasn't like, from what I understand, it wasn't like that's how she looked when he picked her head up.
Yeah, there was a change of expression.
It was after he smacked her, like yeah. Her cheeks flushed, and she basically went into a rage right before she died.
He got 11 years for that?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah, the French did not screw around. You didn't do that. That was a huge lapse in humanity.
And taste.
Yeah.
Cut off the head's fine. Just yeah. Smacking around.
Well, again, remember that this is the time. This is 1793.
Yeah,
France
sure.
Officially adopted the guillotine in 1792 and used it until 1977.
Yeah.
That was the last guy to have his head cut off by the French state.
Uh-huh.
It was a rapist, murderer, immigrant who hit death row. And then 3 years after that, France was like, we're done with the death penalty.
Isn't that crazy? People were like partying in Studio 64, 54.
With their disco eyes.
64? Where in the world did that come from?
So,
yeah, and then all of a sudden in France they're cutting people's heads off still.
Right, but again, remember, they adopted it the year before. This guy smacked Charlotte Corday's face the year after they adopted it.
Yeah.
And people are like, I don't think that's supposed to happen. So from that moment on, and probably before that, because, Chuck, there have been other instances of people in history who had their heads taken off skillfully. For example, Anne Boleyn.
Yeah.
King Charles I.
Yeah.
They had their heads taken skillfully, and both of them were reported to try to speak. Like they were moving their lips or their eyes were right. Moving, right?
This is not funny. It's just...
It's insane.
Yeah. I'm not laughing because I think this is funny.
And there's a huge debate that's become increasingly one-sided in favor of what we're talking about today. The other side is, well, this is just like ghost electrical activity.
Yeah, like you prick a frog 10 minutes after it is dissected and they're still going to move. They have that stimuli.
Or Marshall Brain has that very popular post on the blogs about sprinkling salt on frogs' legs and making them move.
Oh, really?
Surely you've seen it.
I don't think I have.
You have to check it out.
Really?
It's crazy, yeah. But, yes, yeah, so that's if you cut a leg off. Or you cut an arm off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's remnant electrical activity.
Yeah.
It's the same thing in the head.
Right.
It's still electrical activity. The problem is you don't experience pain and fear and terror in your arm.
No.
Your arm feels absolutely nothing. All sensations that we experience, whether it's our arm being cut off or, you know, feeling terror at seeing our arm cut off.
Yeah.
All of that is in the head. So when you decapitate the head and there's still electrical activity, the chances are that it is conscious experience.
Yeah, your brain has, it's not like your head got bashed in. Your brain is very much intact.
Yes.
It's just not attached to the lower half.
And it still has plenty of oxygen and plenty of blood to deliver that oxygen for a few seconds. And that's what's required. As long as your brain hasn't suffered any damage, as long as you have oxygen, you have blood, you are likely going to experience consciousness. And this is pretty much the conclusion that people have arrived at. Like, yeah, if you cut someone's head off, cleanly and quickly, mm-hmm. they're going to know what's going on for a little while afterward.
Yeah, and how long is very much up for debate. They've tested, or not tested, but they've seen evidence in other mammals up to like a half a minute.
Yeah.
Chickens are very famous for running around the barnyard with no heads for a little while.
Did you ever hear the story of Mike the Headless Chicken?
Or for a very long time in Mike's case.
18 months.
Yeah.
But Mike the Headless Chicken, and if you're interested in that, type in Mike the Headless Chicken, How Stuff Works, and it'll bring up some things here or there, including a blog post I wrote on it. But he was different because the farmer missed his brainstem, and chickens are almost all brainstem.
Yeah.
But Mike lived like an extra 18 months.
All brainstem
and
good juicy breast and
exactly.
wings.
Yeah. And he choked on a kernel of corn. That's how Mike died after having his head cut off.
How's he feeding it, though?
With a dropper.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense. Let's tell some more stories, anecdotal stories about people living and making faces.
Okay.
After their head's been cut off.
Okay.
Because those are interesting.
Yeah, they are.
In 1989, an Army veteran was in a car crash with a friend. His friend was decapitated, sadly, and he looked at his friend's face, not attached to his body, and saw a distinct change in expression from, he says, quote, first of shock and confusion, and then terror or grief.
It's horrific.
It is horrific. You mentioned Anne Boleyn and King Charles. There was one story, a very dubious one, that's not in his biographies, but Antoine Lavoisier in 1794 apparently agreed to try and blink for as long as he could afterward.
Yeah, he was a French chemist around the time of the Revolution, right?
Yeah, so he reportedly blinked for about 15 to 20 seconds.
Yeah.
But there was also another murderer named Larsenaire who said, all right, I'm going to wink at everyone after my head's cut off if I can.
Right.
He didn't wink.
Yeah. There is an account that is not dubious. It's probably the most scientific observation.
This one's awesome.
Of consciousness following decapitation ever. It's very famous, and it is verified as far as I know. In 1905, a guy named Dr. Boreau, basically got permission to study the decapitated head of a murderer named Henri Longueuil, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so he was right there, right at head level when Longueuil's head came off.
He had his plan in place, I assume.
He immediately picks up the head and starts experimenting on it. And over the course of 25 to 30 seconds, the physician basically, he said, Longueuil! And Longueuil opened his eyes and focused them.
Yeah.
His head, just his head. Focused him on Dr. Boreau and then kind of like faded out again.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor said, Longueuil! And Longueuil opened his eyes again and focused them. He says, undeniably focused them on the doctor's eyes again. Mm-hmm. And then he tried it a third time and then nothing.
So that was his plan, was just yell his name?
Yeah.
I guess it worked.
But it did work. He said that his observations were that this decapitated head went from its eyes closed or glazed over to, you know, consciousness coming back into it and it focusing its eyes on him because as a response to his name being called.
Wow.
Yeah.
And 1795, a German researcher, S.T. Summering.
Mm-hmm. This is the worst one, if you ask me.
He said that there was a physician inspecting a head and poked the spinal canal with his finger, and that the head, the person, grimaced horribly and they grind their teeth. So it's almost as if the head was saying, I know you think I'm dead, but that really, really hurts.
Yeah, the spinal canal is where your spinal cord is in your spine. So you would think that there was a little bit left because he was poking it up into the spinal cord with his finger. And I can't imagine the excruciating pain that would cause.
Well, the doctor I found that said that he thought it was decidedly painful, that's what he said. He's like, you can't expose and cut the spine like that without there being a lot of pain.
Yeah, and that was S.T. Summering, right? In 1795.
Yeah.
Arguing in the French newspapers to stop cutting people's heads off. Well, they listened a little less than 200 years later.
Yeah.
So, I think the answer to this one is yes, you stay conscious after your head is cut off from your body, at least for several seconds.
That's right.
Right?
Well done, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Good article.
That was the Stuff You Should Know episode entitled Do You Stay Conscious After Decapitation? Originally podcast at HowStuffWorks.com on April 26, 2011. This is the radio version of the Stuff You Should Know podcast. Now for part two, Josh and Chuck examine another life and death issue, the very difficult topic of suicide bombing. This episode was originally podcast on June 21st, 2011.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. With me, as always, is Charles W. Chuck Bryant, looking as spry as ever. You ever seen Bad Santa?
Yeah.
Remember the kid? He's like, your granny, is she spry? And he's putting on a ski mask, and they come in the door, and he goes, granny, are you spry?
Really?
Yeah. And she's like, I'll make you some sandwiches. Now, you're looking very spry today, Chuck.
You've done something that you've never done to me before.
What, man? What's going
on? You literally put a video on your laptop and just turned it around and then started the podcast. And I'm waiting to see what happens because I think it might have something to do with the podcast.
But did you see it?
Yeah.
Did it happen?
It happened.
It's pretty awesome.
And it has nothing to do with what we're podcasting.
No.
Does it?
All right. I just wanted you to see it, buddy.
General interest.
I will be putting that on the Facebook page, okay? Because ain't no party like our Facebook page's party.
Yeah, you're into people getting flung off of things, apparently.
I'm in a little bit of that mood right now, yeah. How are you doing?
I'm great.
Well, good. We should probably say something first.
An announcement, perhaps?
We have an announcement. These are the announcements over the PA.
Yes, New York City. Again, I know everyone outside of New York is like, really? Again? But
again,
that's where the action is. And we're doing a live show, a live podcast, mm-hmm. / sort of like a variety show.
It is. We're having some of our friends join us and do things that have nothing to do with the podcast. So, yes, that's variety right there.
Yeah. And this is for SiriusXM. We're doing a live show for their 4th of July extravaganza weekend.
Yes. And since it's live, we like to do things in front of a studio audience, right? We
yes.
like to have people staring at us while we work.
Because it's weird if we call for that and it's just empty chairs.
Right. So if you want to come, they can come, right?
Yes. And we will have, we know a few details now for today. It is Friday, mm-hmm. July 1st.
That's right. We're kicking off the 4th of July weekend.
It will be at the SiriusXM Studios. We know that. We don't know exactly how we're going to get tickets, but we're going to put that on Facebook and then get that information and have that on podcast in the next couple of weeks.
That is exactly right. So all you have to do is go to our Facebook page after you hear this, and there should be details up. I'm sure we'll run them again and again. And we'll post some stuff on Twitter. That's facebook.com/stuffyoushouldknow. And our Twitter handle is at SYSKpodcast.
That's great, buddy.
Yeah.
Back to it?
Yeah. We should probably tone it down a little bit because this is a grim, grim subject we're about to talk about.
Yeah, that was the first minute was about all the fun we're going to have here.
Yeah. So, Chuck, I got an intro for you.
Okay.
I was jogging. Yumi and I were jogging on okay. treadmills, as is our wont usually. And I prefer treadmills because I can watch TV while I do it and just totally forget that I'm running, right?
That kills me.
But it works so well. Like, I'm up to like 5 miles each time.
Right. You know what's sobering, though?
What?
Go try to run a single mile on pavement.
I don't need to. There's no TVs on pavement. You
it's
know?
Much different.
During one of these ventures, uh-huh. I was watching CNN, and this weird, it was Wolf Blitzer, and this weird segment came on where one of Wolf Blitzer's journalist was in Libya mm-hmm. meeting with the family of a man who had blown himself up in a car full of explosives to gain entry for Libyan rebel fighters into this city.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very disputed city. I can't remember which one. And the guy was sitting down with the family, the two daughters and the wife, who were grieving but holding a picture of the man. Talked to his best friend who picked up the pieces of the guy. And I realized it took me a minute, but it was dawning on me that this is exactly what, say, Afghani or Taliban-y state television would do with one of their suicide bombers. It was just like the embargo on disgust over suicide bombing as a general rule was lifted because someone CNN was rooting for blew himself up.
Right.
And suddenly it was okay. But I mean, like, step for step, it was like a celebration of this man's heroism.
Right.
For blowing himself up.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was really nuts. And I guess it's probably as unobjective as I should be throughout this podcast, but it struck me as really, really strange. I wrote a blog post on it called CNN Oddly Celebrates Suicide Bomber as Hero or
yeah,
something
I remember
like that.
Yeah.
But it was just so weird. And there's in the blog post, there's video. Somebody found it and posted it. So there's video of this weird segment that just sticks out like a sore thumb. And I guess what I learned is that my personal opinion is suicide bombing is wrong, no matter what side is doing it.
I think I would agree with that.
All right, so this is a relatively new thing, right? Suicide bombing, it's new because their bombs are fairly new, right?
Yeah.
But it's far, far more ancient than that.
It is.
The concept of killing yourself or dying in the name of religion is pretty ancient.
Oh, yeah. You want to go all the way back to martyrdom in general?
Might as well.
Okay. Start at the beginning. Martyrdom is what we're talking about, obviously. When you talk about suicide bombing, it's forsaking your own life for a higher cause, for a principle, for your faith. Anything that is not for your direct, like, earthly benefit, but maybe benefit later on to elevate your cause. But right. Benefits for you in the afterlife.
And so generally that's what we suspect make suicide bombers tick. That's what is martyrdom. And it's because, although it is like a very deep, there's a deep religious affiliation between martyrdom and suicide like this.
Yeah,
suicide bombing.
In this case,
it doesn't necessarily have to be religious. It can be
sure.
Your side, your cause. Like the 49-year-old oil worker who is Libyan was for the rebel faction. It had nothing to do with religion. He was just willing to die for his cause,
right.
As all suicide bombers are.
Yeah, religion kicks it up a little notch, though.
So, well, the reason why is because it's so ingrained. The two are so entangled from such an ancient place, right? Like R. Lamb, who did this article, who did this.
He wrote it.
He traces martyrdom back to the 2nd or 3rd century B.C., right?
What, with King Nebuchadnezzar?
Yeah.
Yeah, the famous story in Bible history, the book of Daniel. We all know King Nebuchadnezzar gave, as the Beastie Boys call them, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
Yeah, I can't see those three names together
without
thinking about that too.
Yeah, well, Beastie Boys were three Jewish guys. That's probably why they called themselves that in the song. And they in the Bible story, Nebuchadnezzar gave them the choice: you can renounce your Jewish faith, or you can burn alive. And they said, you know what? We're the Beastie Boys, and we don't give in to anybody. And so we're going to not renounce our faith. They were thrown into the fiery furnace, and they lived.
Right.
Which the lesson there was, an early lesson in martyrdom, which was, hey, you know what? God's going to protect those who die in his name.
Doesn't it make you wonder, like, don't you tend to think that in stories like that, somewhere, eons ago, something happened, possibly with these three people.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
Oh, do you mean
that,
like,
eventually got translated into, they were thrown into this furnace and they walked out unscathed? Like, did somebody, like, lose their grip on them and they skirted across like a campfire?
You know what my
thought
is?
And like their robes didn't catch and everybody was like, oh my God, you know? And then it just to make it more easily digestible for the masses, it was transformed into this larger thing.
My feeling when it comes to parables like this, where to me it's obvious that someone wasn't unscathed in a burning fire, was that maybe someone was burned. Like they were being tortured and saying, renounce your religion, being burned with like fiery torches or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they refused and refused and they couldn't be broken. And so they were set free. And that becomes a parable in the way of something miraculous like this.
That makes sense. It's good analysis.
I'll probably get killed for that.
But the point is, the idea was that God's got your back if you're willing to die for him, right?
Yes.
But that eventually transformed into what people still believe today, that toil on this planet leads to bounty in the next life.
Yeah.
The big three all believe that. And you can trace that back to the early church, the early Jewish faith, the early Christian faith, and the early Muslim faith. And martyrdom goes back just as far and comes from the same tree, the idea that if you sacrifice yourself, you're going to gain reward after this. So what's a few minutes of pain for a lifetime of happiness and pleasure?
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and the non-suicide version where you're actually killing other people in the name of your God goes back to maybe not the first time, but one good example Robert used was in 64 AD, rather than surrendering to the Roman authorities, a rebel group basically killed their own, themselves and every last man and woman.
This one, I think, was probably literal.
Yeah, probably so.
That is, like, do you think about how that would be treated today, though?
Yeah.
Like, the authorities are coming, and you kill every man, woman, and child inside, and...
Sounds like a standoff at a...
at Waco or something.
Ranch, yeah.
So, but your point is, and I think the larger point is that people were willing to kill themselves, kill those close to them, and kill others eventually in the name of God.
Yeah.
And expected some sort of reward for it.
Right. So you were talking about the rise of Islam.
Right. So it was AD 610 when the prophet Muhammad received his first vision, right?
Yeah.
And basically was set about going forth to found Islam. And within 14 years, he'd amassed something of an army and was taking on other people in the area, right?
Right.
It was pretty successful at it, right?
Yeah.
So what I gained from this, and I'm certainly not a scholar on Islam at all, I'm not a scholar on any religion, but the Islam came out of a place of strife and battle, and so thusly this concept of jihad came about fairly early on.
Yeah, there's two parts to jihad. If you've heard that word a lot, used probably for the second part, which was a righteous battle in the physical world. But the first part of jihad means it's an inward struggle of the soul in Arabic. So it's a two-pronged thing there. And the Quran basically vindicated defense in combat in the name of protecting the faithful.
Right.
As well as retaliation. So it's traced back to the Quran as far as probably the birth of the notion of something like a suicide bombing, even though it certainly doesn't say that. Anything about that anywhere in the Quran.
Right. So jihad played a big role in the Crusades, which was the Christian version of the Holy War, right?
Yes.
That was taking it to the Muslims' doorstep, basically invading the Middle East, right? Europeans invading the Middle East.
Yeah.
That was the Crusades. So from these conflicts during the Dark Ages, the Medieval Ages, the Crusades, and after the birth of Islam, this idea of taking a single person and going and doing as much damage as you possibly could came about. So do you remember in the sniper podcast, we talked about snipers being considered militarily force multipliers?
Yes.
So are suicide assassins.
Absolutely.
And the term assassin actually comes out of this era and from the Middle East. From the word hashishin.
Yes, Persian word, the name of a radical Shiite sect. Didn't know that.
Yeah, so hashish and assassin are one and the same.
Hashishin.
Hashishin.
Assassin.
Right.
Yeah, it sounds more like it that way.
The you may recognize the word hashish as a type of pot residue. So if you find it odd that the word hashish pops up, be advised that the sect, the Hashishin, smoked hash as part of their religious ritual.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They were also the ones, though, who would go out and they were tasked with killing public officials in very public places to basically terrorize the population. Like if you kill somebody like that, you cut someone's head off in a crowded square,
yeah,
you're going to die. But the leader's head just got cut off in front of me, and now I'm really freaked out.
Yeah, it was the first early versions, ancient versions of what would later become suicide bombings.
Right.
But that sect was wiped out by Mongols in 1257, and there was kind of a break on this activity for a while as far as world history goes, and then you get to World War II and the Japanese kamikaze pilots, who are most essentially suicide bombers.
Right.
Except by way of a plane.
Yeah, through the Bushido code.
Yeah, but you usually think suicide bombing is someone on foot. But it can really, you know, you can do it. There's been boats, there's been cars and trucks.
Trucks.
Humans walking. and then obviously planes flying into aircraft carriers.
Really, a mail cart filled with explosives, you're going to get the same.
Yeah.
You're a suicide bomber.
Well, Robert Lamb puts the first modern suicide attack in Lebanon in 1981 during civil war between Christian and Muslim militants. And there was a lone suicide bomber, a Shiite, hit an Iraqi embassy in Beirut. And the U.S. entered the conflict the next year. In 1983, a suicide bomber drove into the U.S. embassy. I remember that, actually, killing 63 people.
Yeah, that was in April.
And most folks say this is like the beginning of the modern suicide mission.
Right. And then in October, two truck bombs drove into the Marine barracks in Beirut and killed 299 people.
Yeah.
French and American. I think 241 Marines. So, like you said, that's the birth of the modern suicide bomber. And unfortunately, it's just basically been gaining momentum ever since. This whole concept of I'm going to strap a bunch of explosives to myself and walk into a crowd and blow myself up and kill as many other people as I possibly can.
Yeah, let's poke around inside the mind, because people have been curious what kind of person does this. Because obviously, if you look at just from a straight physical standpoint, they did find between the ages of 18 and 24 is your average age of a suicide bomber.
Yeah, apparently Israel conducted studies in the late 90s to figure out what they, you know, who suicide bombers were.
Right. So the sense of despondency in teens is playing a part here. The whole world is against them. Teens, how many teens feel that way? I know I did.
Yeah.
And it's no different in other countries. Combine these feelings with tyranny, you're oppressed, you're angry, and then the final censure here is usually, and I think they even have a study, that there's some sort of personal loss attached to the person that ends up being picked to carry out the mission.
Right.
Like their parents were killed.
Or wounded or put in prison.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah, it wasn't a study, but it said an Israeli psychiatrist sifted through the lives, is how Robert put it, and they did discover, in almost all cases, connections to like slain or wounded family members or friends.
And for the most part, they were males, but as time's worn on, women, children, older people have all joined the echelons of suicide bombers, right?
Yep, they're usually very poor.
Yeah. There was, did you hear about the woman from, I guess she was a Chechen extremist in Moscow on New Year's Eve? She had a suicide belt and was getting ready to walk out into Red Square to blow herself up and take just tons of people with her.
And she decided it didn't match her purse?
She didn't make it out of the apartment because she got a spam text from her cell phone provider saying, Happy New Year, and it blew her up.
Really?
Yeah.
In her room?
Yeah, in her apartment.
Wow.
She didn't have her cell phone off, which apparently is standard procedure.
Turn your cell phone off.
Like they went out and bought a cell phone just for that purpose. And
right.
The provider sent out a spam text to everybody because, you know, cell phone providers aren't thinking like, well, we're providing service to somebody who's going to blow up a bunch of people as a terrorist.
So they're saying we want to tell everyone Happy New Year.
Exactly.
Wow. I didn't hear about that.
It's true.
So one other common trait is that they obviously are willing to die for their cause, but they are also willing to kill for their cause. Most terrorists don't have they have no empathy for the suffering of other people. And it helps that in the case of us versus them, that the them is very, very different from themselves.
Right.
Which is certainly the case with the Middle East and the United States. Couldn't be any more different as far as countries go.
Right.
And people go.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely a whole sentiment that occupation and invasion fans the flames of suicide bombing.
Well, yeah, because you see Americans as an invader and an occupier and a savage.
And a non-believer, which is a big part, that part about jihad in the Quran.
Right.
Says basically like this is what happens to non-believers. This is what you do to non-believers.
Right.
To an extent.
Robert points out that if suicide bombers were left just completely alone, they might want to back out or think twice. So that's why they surround them toward go time with a social network of supporters to say, you know, you're doing the right thing. They isolate you from your family and friends.
Right.
And show you videos, martyrdom videos. to reinforce that what you're doing is the
right thing.
Well,
no, you make a martyrdom video.
Oh, you make your own?
Saying, like, I'm about to blow a bunch of people up, and I can't wait to get to the afterlife, and I'm like a true believer.
You're right. I read that wrong.
And so that is... It's not only inspiring, it's also like you can't back out now. You've made your video.
Right.
Like you this is your point of no return.
Well, because, yeah, that'd be probably even more shameful.
But I think people, you know, that survival instinct is very strong. So these people that are handling them, usually one of them will go with the suicide bomber to the target area and will basically keep them encouraged and on track and... I imagine we'll blow them up if they decide that they want to back out.
Yeah, well, and beyond that, sometimes it's planned that way. Sometimes the assistant has the detonator to prevent any kind of back out.
I think that is probably a backup detonator, yeah.
You think?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's my suspicion.
So we're talking about the nuts and bolts of it all of a sudden, then. Let's go ahead with that.
You mean the shrapnel?
Yeah, suicide bomber. It's not a very elaborate, expensive operation. It costs about $150 probably worth of explosives and one human life willing to do so.
Yeah.
And you've got yourself a suicide bomber, whether it's a duffel bag full of stuff or something you strap on your chest. Like you said, they've used trucks and boats.
Well, duffel bags are apparently out of vogue because you'll get shot in the head if you look like you are even remotely Middle Eastern and you have a duffel bag.
Right.
At least if you're in London in 2005 and you're Brazilian, right?
Yeah.
But you were saying this, it's just one person with a duffel bag or a vest or a belt.
Yeah.
And the attack of a suicide bomber is threefold, right? One, it kills a bunch of people. So it's terroristic. Two, it draws a lot of attention to this cause that at least one person is willing to die for. And then three, it's a force multiplier because it has like a huge effect on morale and the psyche of the population.
Yeah. So but it can also go the other way, as pointed out with World War II. It can either, like, it's happened both ways in America because when 241 Marines were killed in the truck bombing in 1984, President Reagan said in his memoir that had a big deal with his pulling out of that region. Like, he was like, you know what? Forget that. These people are willing to do this. I'm getting my guys out of there. Or in the case of World War II with the Japanese, let's drop two bombs on their country that they won't be able to recover from because they're willing to fly their planes into our aircraft carriers.
You know, that's not how the Japanese tell it.
How do they tell it?
They tell it like they were starting to make moves that they were willing to surrender, and the Americans had so much money invested in this research that they basically needed and wanted to see what happened.
It certainly doesn't surprise me there are two versions of that story.
Yeah.
That's the way history works.
So, Chuck.
Yes.
What are these things made of? You said you can fill a truck, a belt, all this stuff. What is it?
Well, it varies, of course, between what your resources are. I think in the early days, they would just rejigger landmines and use those. But now it's everything from TNT to something called TATP, triacetone, triperoxide, and then other plastic explosives. Stuff that can do a lot of damage.
Right.
And they found, too, that the more people around the suicide bomber, the better. Obviously not for those people close in proximity. But if you hear that there's a suicide bomber suspect and all of a sudden the crowd disperses, it's going to have a blast zone that's much greater and cover much more area.
Because the thick mass of people around that person create basically a human shield.
Yeah.
Which is pretty serious stuff.
And in London, 2005, you want to...
I talked about that guy, remember?
Oh, the guy, is that what you meant by shot in the head?
Yeah, he got shot in the head 7 times.
Yeah, and he was not a suicide bomber.
No, he's just some guy from Brazil.
Mistaken identity.
Yeah, that was a pretty jumpy time, if I remember correctly.
Yes, it was. You got anything else?
No.
Oh, I thought the very end had a very interesting thing that Israeli settlers were trying was they proposed burying suicide bombers in pigskin body bags.
Yeah, I saw that.
as a way of discouraging suicide bombers from, because I guess if they think, if I'm going to be buried in pigskin, that's not the afterlife that I'm looking for.
Right. But the problem is, and Robert does a good job pointing this out, I think, when you... The suicide bombing is capable of dehumanizing on both levels, right?
Yeah.
That would have not only, dehumanized the suicide bomber, but it dehumanized the Israelis, right?
Mm-hmm.
So part of the whole feedback mechanism for suicide bombings is that one side doesn't see the other as human any longer.
Right.
Right? You're willing to die for your cause, so you're crazy. Or... you are worth dying to kill because I don't see you as a person any longer.
Yeah.
And so that would have been counterproductive, I'm sure.
Good job. This is a tough one.
Yeah, it was. I'm glad we got through it, man.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a tough topic. I hope we explained, like, how it works in the history. And was it good?
Yeah.
You've been listening to Josh and Chuck and the radio version of Stuff You Should Know. If you'd like to contact Josh or Chuck, you can email them at stuffpodcast@howstuffworks.com. You can subscribe to Stuff You Should Know and other podcasts at howstuffworks.com as well as on iTunes. This is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and online at WFMU.org.
Downtown Soulville Show, WFMU. Mr. Fine Wine's my name. I'll be spinning Soul 45s for you for the next hour. I want to thank everybody once again who came out last week to Coney Island. What a blast that was. I had such a good time. Lots of familiar faces, lots of unfamiliar faces. Looked like most people were having a really good time. Also want to thank the people who made that happen, especially Liz Berg. Thanks, Liz. Lots of good. That wasn't last week. That was two Fridays ago. Oh, my God. I'm in a time warp. I wasn't even here last week. Thanks, Dave Amos, for filling in. I was back home replenishing the record coffers in Detroit. You'll hear some of the fruits of my trip on this show. Stay tuned.
People get inside.